Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 460. Science Faction, your weekly corona update. Okay, today is Sunday, July 12th, 2020, and our numbers stand as followed. Infected worldwide, 12.95 million. In the U.S., 3.39 million. Deaths worldwide, 569,000. U.S., 137,000. Now, as we talk about every time, those aren't the real numbers. There's more people infected, as a story we're about to talk about in Central Asia will be a perfect example of. And there's also people who are dying who aren't being counted because they're not being tested as they die, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the other things I want to keep reiterating, and it's something that we've talked about in some of our major stories in past episodes, is that just because somebody doesn't die from the virus doesn't mean that they don't have lifelong or very serious effects. That might mean crazy medical bills, but it might also mean long-term organ damage. Some of those people will need lung transplants. Some of the lung damage that we're seeing, as we talked about last week, is on asymptomatic individuals, meaning even though you're not coughing or showing any signs, your organs can be being eaten up inside you to such a degree that it could cause organ damage, sometimes permanent organ damage. So don't just look at it as deaths as the only possible negative outcome and everything else is positive, they recovered. That might not necessarily be the case. And there might be long-term deaths, undoubtedly for the next few decades, of people who got sick now, but their ailments kind of caught up with them later on. I want to start off by going over some brief facts from a New York Times article that will kind of put you in the current of what's going on right now with this disease in the United States. Over the past 9 days, the U.S. has set record daily case numbers 5 times, meaning 5 of the last 9 days were the highest new case numbers we've had. Our average U.S. death numbers are around 700 per day on Saturday. That's up from earlier in July when it was back around the 400-some-odd number, but nowhere near our high average daily deaths, which was up in the 2,200 range back in April. And in the past week, 8 states have logged single-day death records. Those are Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, and Tennessee. For those of you people who are outside of the United States, you might not hear what jumps off the page to most of our U.S. listeners, which is these are in general rural areas. There's a lot of rural areas in Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, and Tennessee. And we're going to talk a little bit about how this is really hitting those rural areas. We've been talking about this for months, about how it's going to hit those areas really hard. It's starting to now. Currently, just the county of Los Angeles has over 100,000 infected cases. I repeat, 100,000 infected cases in one city. And even though the entire country isn't like those 8 states I mentioned before with new single-day record deaths, 40 of the United States' 50 states are seeing an increase in new COVID-19 cases. And that's, by the way, as many of those states have been ramping up the idea of opening back up over the last 2.5 to 3 weeks. We keep flip-flopping between we want to open up and, oh no, the hospitals had to shut down because there were too many people inside of them. We've been talking for a while about how it's going to hit rural areas, and now we've been seeing the majority of the deaths and infections and everything in urban environments, which makes sense. That's where travel comes to from international places. That's where there's a lot of people and density, so the virus gets around very easily. We would expect to see that be the first areas impacted, but as we talked about, we were going to see little snaking tentacles that go off into more rural areas and starts getting them infected, and that's where things are going to get really bad, because that is where you don't have as high quality medical facilities per amount of people. So for the same amount of sick people, we just don't have the same amount of beds or ventilators or doctors or anything else, and this is really starting to catch up with us in the U.S. For those of you guys who are in other countries, you might not necessarily grasp the severity of this situation, but because of the unique healthcare situation of the United States, it means that not only do you have to be somewhat rich to have decent healthcare, but you also kind of have to live in the right place, because unless you're going to travel someplace else, you're stuck with the facilities around you, and the facilities in rural areas aren't great, usually even if you're rich, so you usually have to go someplace else. So this is really starting to mount up. I am broadcasting from San Diego County. Our neighboring county, the one next door to us, Imperial County, which is also in Southern California, but nowhere near the coast, so it's much cheaper. They only have 2 hospitals between the entire county and both have essentially shut down for allowing people in. Now, I think they have since restarted allowing regular people in, but they basically had to shut the doors to a lot of patients because COVID made them not only full to their fullest extent, but the main hospital actually had to get army tents to place in their parking lot to use as hospital rooms because they were so out of space. They stopped taking new patients and literally sent them here to San Diego. They went, sorry, you got a medical emergency? You need to go to San Diego. There's no hospitals here. So when we talk about what level of sick do we have to get before the U.S. healthcare system crashes, the level of sick of Imperial Valley last week. So that's really terrifying because we're getting to the point we talked about on this show where the medical facilities of rural areas are not going to be able to take care of stuff. And so then they're going to start sending people out to here like they're doing now. And right now in Riverside, that's starting to go on as well. And they're sending people to LA. Well, what happens if all of those places get hit at once? You could theoretically, and this is not actually even theoretical at this point, you could very feasibly have a time where you go to the hospital and they say, sorry, there's no bed for you. You can't come in. And there's no place within hundreds of miles that will take you either. Good luck at home. It bears repeating that also this is not just a COVID issue because guess what? Everybody else who normally needs to use the hospital, car accident victims, kids who fall off their bikes, whatever it is, those people now cannot necessarily get in and use those facilities. So you can have fatalities due to COVID that aren't even people infected with COVID. They're just the people who can't get medical treatment because all the beds are taken by COVID patients. One interesting thing to note is if you've been paying keen attention to the numbers that I state at the beginning of each episode, even as we're seeing rising cases, we're not always seeing synchronized rising death rates. And you might wonder why that is. Looking into the numbers, it kind of spells it out a little bit more. One is that we are getting better at treating COVID. We find things like remdesivir, we're finding drugs that help fight off the infection, we're finding techniques and ways to move around ventilators that are working. We are figuring out how to keep people from dying, certainly better than we were in March. If you had two identical twin brothers and one caught the disease in March and one caught it now, the exact same disease, like viral copies, the exact same disease, the one who caught it now would have a much better chance of surviving because we know so much more about the disease. That's great news. That means as we go further into this infection, hopefully even as infected numbers goes up, infected deaths will go down. That is fantastic. But it also makes it hard to gauge whether we're doing something right or wrong. You know, we're having out of control infections here, but the death rates aren't necessarily reflecting that. So what does that mean? It means that a total gauge of what's going on can't necessarily be deaths. And we've already talked about how it can't be infection rates either, because infection rate just means the people who tested positive. And so you can make that infection rate go up or down by testing more people or not testing more people. It seems like the one thing that seems fairly steady and constant through this are hospitalizations. And that's why that's a really easy metric to use, because hospitalizations is a point where the person is no longer able to be taken care of at home. They're taken to the hospital because their family or whatever has fear for them. If they're not breathing or something's wrong, the family doesn't really have a choice, right? Whether they take them or the ambulance takes them, like, they gotta call somebody. So it's not so much like, oh, I wanna get this test or I don't wanna get the test or the test's available or not available. You just have to go. And unlike the deaths thing, even though we're getting better at keeping people from dying with it, we're not getting better at helping people breathe at home when they have it. So the same amount of people still need to go to the hospital. So it seems to be a more accurate metric or gauge, which is why the crazy rate of hospitalizations in certain rural areas, specifically as we just talked about, Eastern Southern California, is very concerning because it means that we're really dealing with a high amount of sick people in a lot of these areas. Speaking of rural areas, a huge outbreak of otherwise unspecified pneumonia in Damien's favorite country, Kazakhstan, has killed at least 1,700 people, and it's almost certainly undiagnosed corona, highlighting why we should be really aware of these global numbers, especially in terms of like developing nations. I mean, so you have a country that's going like, no, this is fine. We don't have that many infections. We're fine. We're good. It's probably not that. But there's just a bunch of people dropping dead that otherwise were totally fine. So chances are it's probably that. It could be another infection. It could be something else. They could have a flu variant going around. It could be that. But chances are the death rates match. Those mysterious 1,700 deaths are probably not mysterious enough to call Robert Stack over. I think we can pretty much solve this unsolved mystery today. And for the big story this week, I really wanted to talk about vaccines. Now, I've talked about this a bit before. I actually got some questions when I was hosting Nerd Night this week from one of the scientists about this, and I wanted to kind of get into this a little bit because people ask me all the time about vaccines. And I tell them I do a weekly show about the coronavirus. I read almost every single article that comes out of a major published journal about it. And let me tell you, when it comes to everything else, you probably can tell I'm a little bit pessimistic. I yell at you to wear your mask. I remind you of the organ damage you can get even if you don't get symptoms. I talk about how many people die. A little bit of a rain cloud when it comes to corona. But the one thing that I feel like I'm more optimistic than everybody else on is vaccines. And I don't know why that is. I was trying to ask, is this because I have a decent insight into what's going on with corona with all the reading and studying and follow-up and shows that I do about it? Or is it my own bias? Am I missing something? And this is really something I shouldn't be super psyched. This is my own malaria drug that I'm touting as a cure that won't work. So I went back and did a real thorough survey of all of the vaccine stuff. And I want to bring you guys up to date on where we are currently at this date, July 12th, in coming to market with a human vaccine for coronavirus. So, there are about 180 vaccine candidates, and at least 20 of them are currently in human trials. Keep in mind, this is all around the world, so this doesn't mean just in the US. Now, most of these target the spike protein that we've talked a lot about. That spike protein is basically how corona gets into our cells. It's how it interfaces. And so if we could find a way to target or attack or change that spike protein or teach antigens or antibodies to go after that particular protein, then we'd have a really powerful tool against this virus, because without that particular protein, it can't get in and infect us and hurt us. Now, we also talked the other week about how it actually might have a few tricks to hide that protein from our immune system, so that might throw a few curveballs our way. But here's what's going on so far with that spike protein research. So there's a China-based company that's developed a hybrid virus vaccine. They take that spike protein we just talked about, and they put it in a regular cold virus, which we remember is a coronavirus, so that works out. That new virus, it's modified so it can infect humans, but so that it can't really replicate. So it gets in your system, but it can't cause out-of-control infection. That one seems to be showing some promise. Right now, Pfizer has four separate vaccine candidates in development just in that one company, one of which is showing high effectiveness with no severe side effects, and it might be available in limited supply by October, and as many as 1 billion doses may be available by early 2021. Another company, Novavax, is going into phase 3 trials right now and intends to deliver 100 million vaccine doses by the end of 2020. There's probably going to be a lot of different vaccine candidates, a lot of different vaccines, because quite frankly, this probably won't be one size fits all. The thing that we end up giving to infants will be different than what we give to old people, than to immunocompromised people or those with diabetes. So it makes sense to have all these different ones going on. And we also have to be very, very careful, because we do know that in the history of vaccines, when we've rushed stuff, stuff goes bad. This happened with polio vaccine. There's a few kids who accidentally got polio because it was bad rushed batch. This happened with a specific flu vaccine back in the mid-70s. Now, this wasn't like the normal annual flu vaccine. This is what I mean. It's when these novel things come out. So this was a specific swine flu that jumped out in the 1970s and came out. We had to manufacture a bunch of vaccines very quickly. And a higher than average percentage of people ended up getting a condition called Guillain-Barré, where it basically causes an autoimmune issue and your immune system attacks you, and it's very unpleasant. Usually insanely rare. Crazy, crazy, crazy rare. You're more likely to die from like rolling out of the bed in the morning wrong. But in that particular case in the 1970s, that one vaccine candidate that went out, a lot more people than usual ended up getting that particular disease. So we do have to make sure that we're doing this well enough and it's safe. And I gotta say that there's been a lot of changes when it comes to clinical trials from 1972 till 2020. So I have much higher confidence in the safety and efficiency and thoroughness of the process as it exists now than back then. So not as much to worry about. We do have to make sure we do this safely, because indeed these are very important vaccines to get out, but we wanna make sure that we don't hurt ourselves in the process. Unlike Wakefield McCarthy, that is a valid concern here. It's very different between talking about an annual flu vaccine that you get regularly or a regular vaccine we get for something like MMR or rabies that's been mass-produced, mass-tried, and everything, and something new. So there is some healthy skepticism we should have there. But notice everything I just said. I was just talking about vaccines coming out in a few months. Huge quantities being available at the end of this year and beginning of next year. Like I've said before, this has an end. And I believe those vaccines are going to be a huge part of it, because we wouldn't even need to get everybody vaccinated. If we got 70, 80% of people vaccinated, and then you add the percentage of the people who've already been infected with the virus, by the way, the vaccine trial candidates are 2 to 3 times stronger immune response than actually having gotten the virus itself. So it's much better for you to get the vaccine than the virus. But between all of those groups of people and the immunocompromised people who will already kind of be avoiding stuff for a while, I don't think we need that high in numbers to be pretty good. And again, like the seasonal flu vaccine, we see that if you get, you know, 20, 30, 40% of people vaccinated, it causes a huge drop. It's not a 20, 30, 40% drop. It's like a 70% drop because they are no longer vector points that help transmit that disease around. So anytime you do that, you're essentially creating these blockades for the virus or the disease to spread. So it might be that we could have a lot of people vaccinated maybe by the end of this year, optimistically, but certainly by the beginning of next year, and enough so that that vaccine could convey protection to the rest of us to some extent. I mean, I think we could feasibly start opening in a real way by the end of this year and be kind of literally beyond this thing, at least as far as the disease go, not necessarily the economic implications, but beyond this thing by mid-2021. So this is not doom and gloom. It's not dire. It's not the worst thing that's ever happened. There's an end in sight, and thankfully there is, because you know what gave us that end? Was it a shitload of people praying in churches? It's a bunch of people busting their asses in labs. That is how society and science makes progress. We go forward by doing the actual work. And that work, thankfully, is being done right now by some of the smartest human beings on this planet. They're putting the whole host of their efforts and minds and abilities into this. And they are going to save our asses. And as many of you guys know, I do this show as a labor of love to promote science and scientific thought and ideas. But in this case, I also want to make sure I give attention and notoriety to a group of really hardworking, brilliant human beings around the world right now who are not seeing their kids, who are not getting their sleep in, who are probably making way less money than they should be or could be on a different private job. And they are saving the motherfucking world. As we speak and as we complain about our lives and we're having to wear masks and quarantines, there are literal superheroes out there using their superpowers, which is their brain and the tools of science and logic, to make sure the rest of us have a world for our kids to live in. And that's fucking awesome. All right, before I go, there was one thing I had to address. I'm so sorry to do this 2 weeks in a row. I know I did the Joe Rogan thing last week, criticizing him about something that he said about Corona. I gotta do it again. I know, it's getting difficult, because I really do enjoy his show, and I really do think he does quite a bit of good work for science education, but every once in a while, it's like his Corona coverage and Graham Hancock are just the two things. Like, he's so generous, he gives, you know, you interview a bunch of scientists, get the information out to the public, but then he takes away so much with just those two things. And he made a passing comment on a podcast I was listening to just recently this week about how a biologist, Brett Weinstein, had told him about how every single day it looks more and more like the virus is engineered. And that's what people think now, is the virus was definitely engineered. And I thought to myself, well, no, I have literally not seen that. In fact, all of the papers that have come across suggesting an artificial origin of the virus are pretty kooky and quacky and literally not even like anything published in peer review. So I thought, that's really weird. That's a weird statement. Let me go back and listen to that episode. So I went and listened to it. I hadn't listened to it before. Brett, who is a biologist, by the way, did mention about 2/3 of the way through this podcast, Brett said that he felt there were some indications that it might be engineered. Not, by the way, that there's more and more mounting evidence every single day, and it looks like that's the case, and that's a preponderance of evidence. Just like, there were some things that made him think this. Even that is a little far to go, but clearly this was a game of telephone in which Joe, unfortunately, exaggerated a little bit. But let's start with the idea that this is not an impossible hypothesis. This is not vaccines cause autism. It could very well be that this got started in a Chinese lab, specifically the Wuhan lab. That's right there, right? So they study coronavirus. Maybe it got out. Not a crazy hypothesis, but it's something that has essentially no real academic support. And so I found it very interesting, one, Joe's initial comment that that's what more and more evidence shows. And so I took down all of Brett's points, and then I went and did a deep dive into the research to see how much of it could be validated. Now, I don't want to condense his points too much, so feel free to go back and listen to that show. I think it's like literally 2 hours into the show. You could skip the first 2 hours. You can go listen to everything he says, but I'm just going to talk about the main points of evidence that he makes to suggest that maybe that this is an engineered virus. He thought that certain genetic tweaks that this particular virus had acquired that made it more virulent, he thought that that might be possible evidence of purposeful engineering. But here's the thing, it can also be part of natural processes. When we talk about genetic manipulation and genes getting put in and out, this is not the same as we would talk about that in our own species, in which our DNA is more difficult to alter, though it still does happen. It's why mammals have placentas. You know, we got some horizontal gene transfer there a long time ago. But it's much more rare. Viruses and bacteria, microbes in general, usually, let's just say they're more genetic fluid as opposed to gender fluid, and they can share and trade and recopy and decopy and do a bunch of stuff so that genes can be traded much more easily. And that can be something, especially if it is a gene that causes more virulence, that's going to be selected for, so it will be more likely to be imported into a novel virus. That is not a great point, right? Because, like, if it wasn't particularly virulent, it wouldn't have become a pandemic. So the only reason we know about it is because it was virulent. So let's say it's rare and there's 1 in 1,000 times this would happen. Well, the other 999 viruses didn't make it out and nobody knows about them. This one did. So, like, again, I don't think that that's great evidence. Number two, Brett feels that the fact that it's more difficult to catch outside is indicative of some accidental evolution that went on from a lab-based creature. Again, a very weird statement, because he even admitted it could be something as simple as UV, which we talked about last week, which would inhibit some amount of catching stuff outside, especially for picking up surfaces and stuff. It could also just be ventilation. It's a respiratory illness. Of course it's more easily spread inside. Like, that is a very weird statement to make. I think a respiratory illness was genetically engineered because it's harder to catch outside. If you think of viral loads and how viral load exposure is going to determine whether or not you get sick or how badly you get sick and all that, of course it would be crazy if this wasn't the case. This seemed like a nonsensical reason to me. And lastly, he brought up the idea that viruses that jump into a new species usually aren't very good at moving around once they get there. So we have this pandemic with all these people getting sick. Clearly, it's good at moving through humans. So that seems like maybe it was engineered to move through humans. Again, this is another really weird example, because there's multiple better ways to explain this. Number one, like we just talked about as an example with our last problem, even if the chances were 1 in 1,000,000, we may have 999,999 flops and this one success. I mean, there's a, you know, we're talking about an area where there are literally billions of people in this part of the world. If some of them get exposed to viruses on a routine basis, then this could very well just be, you know, the law of large numbers. Even if it's incredibly rare, we would expect it to happen, and it's been 100 years since the last pandemic, so maybe that's the right math. Number two, we don't know that it immediately started jumping through people. For all we know, it existed as a low-level infection that was transmitted numerous times to humans and went nowhere. You know, this one pangolin gave it to like 6 people, but it didn't go beyond them, and it wasn't that bad in them. Or even that it was like low-level infectious, bouncing around between a few people. You know, it was one Chinese family, it went around 10 times, and then all of a sudden there was one mutation that made it very virulent and it popped out. That's normal virology. And lastly, here's the biggest problem with that argument. If your argument is, well, it seems weird that it's just jumping around from person to person like this pandemic, right? Because normally if it comes from a different species, it wouldn't be this pandemic. Well, then we would never have pandemics in the past, all right? Like, we had the 1918 flu, we had the 68 flu. We have flus that jump from animals into people, and then they become virulent and they become pandemics. That's how we get them. So if your argument is they're not usually easily transmissible between people, the response is yes, but we know for a fact they also sometimes are. Right. So again, all three of those are very bad arguments. They're almost like anthropomorphic principle arguments. And again, it doesn't mean he's wrong. Hey, tomorrow, if a good genetic study came out and said, look, this is absolutely genetic manufactured, or there's high evidence, I am first on board. Here's the thing, though. The evidence is not there. And his idea that the stuff he sees in this is evidence is crazy, because this is not a dumb person. Go listen to Dr. Weinstein talk. He's not a dumb person. He clearly knows some of what he's talking about. But these arguments are just nonsensical to some extent. This should not be the type of evidence a PhD biologist would accept as likelihood of genetic engineering of a virus that otherwise has totally natural possible origin. Now, while I'm decently competent at microbiology and biology in general, I'm also not an expert. And so because I thought this was pretty important, I went to go talk to somebody who knew a lot more than me. I'm going to keep this person anonymous, but just so you guys know, it hasn't been any of our scientists we have used on our shows. They work for a specific institute that rhymes with RIPS here in San Diego that's fairly well respected and is doing a ton of corona research. Because of that, they asked me to not use their name, but they are a fan of this show. And I wanted to just double check with them and see if I was missing anything. And so this was their response. I think you pretty much nailed it on most of your refutations of Weinstein's points. Not that they're not possible, just that this is in no way evidence for the claim, and is much better explained by statistically more likely causes than by Weinstein's seemingly statistically unlikely cause. I am unaware of any published research in any major peer-reviewed journals that indicate a strong likelihood of the virus being genetically altered. In addition, one would consider that if you did want to genetically alter a virus of this type, you would use a base model that would likely contain SARS-CoV-1, which was the 2003 SARS that came out. If you were engineering a virus for almost any purpose, whether pandemic control or as use of a weapon, you would not downgrade the lethality of that virus down to 0.4 to 0.6%. In fact, in lab strains, we would expect this to be exploited and higher, but almost never lower. When we see the decline of this, it's almost always the case due to natural evolution. Particularly deadly viruses do not spread as well as those less deadly. While it is possible that a Wuhan lab might be experimenting with another substantially less deadly form of the virus, that experimentation would not serve the normal purpose we would expect of such a virology lab. Using a substantially less deadly form of the disease would give you a product that was unusable for the disease itself, or for use as a weapon. Therefore, there is no reason we would expect somebody to genetically engineer a highly infectious agent while spending so much time, energy, and resources making it so much less lethal than its predecessors. It just does not make sense from a lab standpoint. Again, not that it can be possible or they couldn't be studying something else that we are not aware of, just that for every reason we would think, both beneficial and sinister, this does not make sense as a lab-escaped virus. All right, so that was for somebody who knows a little bit more about this stuff than I do, but I will keep you updated. And once again, hey, listen, if we're here from 3 weeks from now and I'm busting out and going, guys, you wouldn't believe what they just published. Oh my God, it looks like it was engineered. I will be the first one to tell you. I promise you, I will be super excited about that news. It'll be horrible, but fuck, that would be a crazy twist of history, right? So I will be the one to tell you, I promise this. But as of right now, that is just not true, no matter how good a scientist Dr. Weinstein may or may not be. In this particular case, it didn't seem to make sense to me. It is not reflected in the literature. And the expert that I consulted, and trust me, this person is absolutely an expert in this field, much more so than Dr. Weinstein himself. That expert says that this does not track right either. So I hope that helps you, and hope that gives you some information you can use. And I hope to see you later this week for Science Faction 461.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.